Catch you later. Ready?
Yes.
House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Today we have three public hearings. We're going to change the order a little bit, and we'll hear them in this order: 2478, 2477, and 2205. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2478. Go ahead. Give us an explanation of the bill, and then we'll see what testimony we have.
Okay, thank you. House Bill 2478 would require that some large industrial appeals for property tax would go directly to the tax court rather than through the Board of Property Tax Appeals. And this was recommended as part of the Task Force on Government Efficiency as one of the changes that could be made to make the system more expedient and efficient.
Thank you. And do we have a sheet? We're getting back into the rhythm of things. It will be a while. Thank you. Two sheets on this bill? No, different bill. Okay. All right. It appears as though the department wants to be heard. And Representative Nathanson. Is Representative Nathanson here? Yeah. Representative Nathanson, why don't you come forward, please? Thank you so much for coming to Revenue early in the morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. I'm here to express enthusiastic support for this idea. This bill is one of several that the House will be hearing that is coming from the Government Efficiency Task Force. As you may recall, that task force looked at a number of program or service areas where the state and local governments are doing some of the same things, have the same activities in the same program area. And just as we recognize that it's important to reset government and start restructuring government, this task force focused on those areas where the state can't do it alone. There are so many areas where we overlap our activities with local government that for us to just figure out within our four walls, let's do our little piece of something better, it was my proposal that we rethink the system as a whole system, and there may be things between the two of us that we can stop doing them twice or find things that we're doing that are unnecessary. So recognizing that need to restructure the delivery of services, state and local governments and organizations worked together to identify opportunities to improve processes, fix problems, eliminate burdensome procedures, and so on. The ideas all were designed to improve efficiency, reduce cost, and in some cases also improve service for the public. The task force approved nearly two dozen ideas, and those are contained in a report that the legislature received a few months ago. Some of those are going to be accomplished through administrative actions, but some of them result in requests for changes to statute. We do need to work better and work smarter and in conjunction with our county partners. So as chair of the task force, I am very happy to let you know that the task force unanimously supported this and the other bill that you're going to be hearing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Nathanson? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And now the department. And you may have a panel. If you do, please bring them forward.
Am I the panel?
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for hearing us today. Elizabeth, our director, was asked to be by Representative Nathanson to be the subcommittee chair for the review of all assessment and taxation issues that counties and the state share, and so I've been asked to kind of give the details on that. We also have a committee member of that subcommittee, Sarah Miller, and she'd like to talk about sort of the process.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Miller. In my professional role, I'm the Policy and Planning Division Administrator for Business Oregon, and I was appointed to the Governor's Efficiency Task Force to represent the, I imagine, the business, our customers' interest in the efficiency process. I like to hold up this chart when we talk about the overlap. Representative Nathanson was talking about the task force was designed for the places in which state government and county government overlap in their service perspective, and there were five subcommittees created: assessment and taxation, human service, public safety, elections, and county services planning. I was asked to serve on the assessment and taxation subcommittee. That group of people studied the property tax system and consulted with Department of Revenue staff. Let me be clear, before this effort, I knew nothing about the property tax system other than being a property tax payer, so we had lots of experts with us, as well as county assessor staff. So in addition to myself and Director Harchenko, Ray Knapp, who served on Governor Kulongoski's office, attended the subcommittee. Mayor Denny Doyle from the city of Beaverton was the city representative. Clark Balfour represented the Special Districts Association. And then Judy Shiprack, who was a commissioner for Multnomah County, was the Association of Counties representative. The subcommittee had five meetings with technical advisors, as well as a public hearing process where members of the general public provided testimony regarding certain of the recommendations. Today I want to tell you that I think this committee was put together to look at things from a does this make sense perspective. The two bills that you're hearing today I think are in the category of really this is so straightforward that it seems crazy, not controversial to me. It makes sense from a public efficiency perspective. 2478, which you'll hear right now, streamlines an appeal process to increase efficiency. Someone in the crowd said, we get to justice faster this way. And so I think that's how you should look about that piece of legislation. And then 2477, which you'll hear next, really brings appropriate technology from the 21st century into the property tax notice system by eliminating written notification, or broadening, doesn't eliminate written notification, but broadens the opportunities in ways that people can be notified. As a passionate public servant, I was excited to be invited to work on the Governor's Efficiency Task Force because I think there are lots of opportunities to improve government service delivery. But as an Oregon taxpayer, I hope these bills are the beginning of a long conversation about things we can do differently, particularly when we work together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Phillips again with the Department of Revenue, and I'm just going to touch on a few of the actual sort of the substantive issues of the bill. And so for 2478, this bill eliminates an intermediary step for large industrial properties that appeal to the Board of Property Tax Appeals. Just to give you a little context, in Oregon, all property is appraised annually by either the Department of Revenue or the 36 county assessors. The county assessors typically will appraise your residential, your commercial, farm, forest, and small industrial properties. The Department of Revenue appraises large industrial properties, which is defined as $1 million or over, and utility companies like airlines and railroads. The focus of this bill is just on those complex industrial properties, and currently there's this process by which they can appeal to what's called a local board of appeals, which every county sets up. They hold hearings for about 3 months every year, and then if they're dissatisfied, they can appeal then on to the tax court. There are two levels at the tax court. There's the magistrate division, which is a more informal process, and then there's an appeal to the regular division, which is the tax court judge in Oregon, Judge Breithoff. There also is a provision in the law that lets these large industrials appeal directly. They can just elect to go directly and skip the Board of Property Tax Appeals process. About half of them just elect and go directly, and the other half end up with an appeal to the Board of Property Tax Appeals. The board is made up of individuals who typically have a real estate background and are familiar with a lot of kinds of sales of property on a residential, commercial, maybe farm, rural properties, but they many times don't have the technical expertise or training to look at a company such as Intel or Precision Cast Parts. The hearings are short, and we have with us today a board chair of the Marion County Board of Property Tax Appeals that could talk about how those experiences actually work from the perspective of the board, so that you can hear that. And I think I will probably leave it there, other than to say that we think this will expedite the actual processing and resolution of accounts. It also saves a period of time.
Let's interrupt for just a second, Representative Berger.
Yeah, John, I'm looking through here and trying to find that definition of large. And you said it's $1 million of value or of tax?
$1 million of value.
Okay. Any property over $1 million of value?
Just industrial.
Okay. I don't want to go look up the ORS.
No. That's fine.
But okay.
It's in a part that's not actually in the bill.
Right. I know. So I just wanted to clarify exactly what we're talking about. And is how many of these are there? Are there lots?
I think there are about 1,300.
Okay. Thank you. I just want perspective. Thank you.
No. That's wrong. There's in the 3,000 range.
Yeah, I was going to say only 13.
About.
I mean, $1 million isn't that much.
Yeah. I sometimes get utility and industrial mixed up. But
okay.
It's in the $3,000 range. I actually have the numbers in my folder.
Okay.
And
I just
about
want
2-3% appeal annually.
Okay. Thank you.
So we think the process is inefficient. Oftentimes, a taxpayer won't appear for their hearing, and then the value is sustained and moved on, and then they can appeal on. Much of the time that's there is used by the department and the taxpayer to work out problems, issues, mistakes, corrections, because we are working off their value that they told us, and sometimes those reports, because the volume is, and there's so much property, so. Anyway, I think I'll leave it there and take questions or turn over to board chair.
Please.
Board chair's turn?
Yeah, I think it is. State your name and then give your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Susan Thompson, and I am the chair of the Marion County Board of Property Tax Appeals. I've been in this position as chair for I don't know how many years, but I have served on the Board of Property Tax Appeals and what used to be called the Board of Equalization since the early 90s. So I do have some experience and a lot of background with the strange thing that we have been put on in our board to deal with properties that actually, even though each one of the members of the board in Marion County and all 36 counties have, as was said, background in real estate, in appraisal, in banking, in any number of things that would apply, a 15-minute hearing put on our table on properties so terribly complex becomes almost silly. What we do at the point of finding these coming through, we just almost know ahead of time that either the petitioner will ask to have it sustained or the board will feel that they don't have enough information and they go ahead and sustain and send it on to magistrate. Our feeling has been ever since I started this process, why are we dealing with this at all? Why does it come through the paperwork procedures that have to be maintained through the county court, through all of the staff that has to deal with it, to get to a conclusion that we would do anyway? So I am fully in agreement with this bill. I think this is a good step forward. It's efficient. It's easy for the taxpayer. It's certainly better for the Board of Property Tax Appeals. And it just makes a lot of sense. I don't know what else to say except that.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. Questions? Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just two questions. I don't have as much comfort in property tax as I would like to have for this, what seems to be a simple question. Is this real property only or personal property as well for the process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vice Chair Air Brewer, this is real and personal.
Real.
Including machinery and equipment.
Okay.
And land.
So when you talk about the $1 million floor, is it million real, million personal property? How do you aggregate that? How do you define the $1 million then?
The $1 million is kind of a discussion between the county and the department, because some companies will border that threshold. Many companies have so much more value than that it's never a question, but there's a few that land in that you know, that, and it actually creates counts that sometimes can bounce back and forth between the department and the county, which creates an inefficient process. And so we have worked with the county to say, this is under $1 million this year. It was over $1 million last year. Do you want us to take it? And so we work that out with the counties to be a little more efficient in how we process that.
And then does this have a cash oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Yes, please.
Thank you. Does it have a cash impact for which method they take for depositing on the property value, the assessment in conflict? Do they have to make a deposit of it completely and have it paid in before appealing to the magistrate, or does this have any impact to the taxpayer at all, depending on the methodology that they take?
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Erbrewer, our experience is that in almost every case, the taxpayer is going to pay the tax on the disputed value. It's very savvy investment principle that if you pay the tax and you entitle to a refund, you will get interest. And it's substantial interest, as many of you know. So it behooves them to pay the tax and then then dispute the value.
Regardless of method.
But it isn't required.
It's, yes, thank you. It's not required that
thank
they pay
you.
It.
Thank you.
Representative, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple of questions about the process here because I haven't personally gone through it before. Does the board that you're a chair of have the authority to make a final decision?
We do, yes. And but then, our decision is appealable.
Right, so that's appealable to the tax court?
Yes, and so our decision would more than likely on a bigger property like this be taken on anyway.
Do you have any statistics that would show us how many cases are ultimately decided by the board versus how many are appealed to the tax court?
I don't have any of that statistics. You may have it, but I do know that speaking for Marion County, and I think for speaking as a representative of all the BOPTAs, it's very few in general.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? I have several, and they're not related to the topic any of the topics that you've talked about yet. And I suspect Representative Benz hasn't asked them because he knows the answers, but I don't. So I'm interested in the appeal in the process. After an assessment's been made and an appeal is made, what happens in the process? And I'm thinking about things like the record. When a matter goes to the tax court, whether it's a initial appeal or an appeal after it's already been through one of the local committees, is that an appeal de novo, or is it an appeal on the record? What's the rule about that?
It's on the record, isn't it?
Is it de novo?
What I mean by that is, does the tax court look at the record that was generated in the earlier stage primarily or only, or do they have their own hearing and gather the information that they will need in order to make a decision in connection with their own hearing?
Mr. Chair, John Phillips, the Department of Revenue. It is a de novo hearing at the Board of Property Tax Appeals. It's very informal. It lasts about 15 minutes.
Now, that's the board.
The board.
Now, how about at the tax court?
At the tax court, the first appeal is to the magistrate division. An appeal from the magistrate order is de novo to the regular division.
So the magistrate has a de novo hearing, and if the taxpayer or presumably the state wants to appeal to the tax judge, that's also a de novo hearing.
Yes.
So at all of these stages, we have an evidentiary hearing of some kind. People bring information in. And at each stage, the person making the decision or the board making the decision bases it on the information that's brought in at the hearing that group conducts.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. That's very helpful. All right. Other questions? Yes, Representative Wand.
Thank you for the second go around, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about the duplication of efforts, as all of us are, but I'm also concerned with kind of a judicial realism. Sometimes getting the parties in the same room, even at a lower level, such as an arbitration or a board appeal, is enough to help move the process forward, and then they can settle the matter on their own. And that's why I was asking about how many cases are resolved at the lower level. So my follow-up question to that, since we don't know the answer, is do we have an estimate on the cost and the difference in cost that's associated at the different levels of the appeal? So, for example, you know, what's our annual cost at the board level? And then what's our annual cost if there was no board and everything went to the magistrate? I assume there's a bump, and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Juan, there is no filing fee with the Board of Property Tax Appeals.
$75.
There's a $75 fee at the Magistrate Division, which is proposed in a bill this session to go up to $250. There are costs that the department incurs by sending our appraisers to all of the 36 counties where there are appeals. We have travel time and FTE that we incur sending them out. Many times the reports are that the taxpayers don't show because, well, for a number of reasons. One, they intend to appeal on, or what's more than likely the case is that we have been working with the taxpayer trying to resolve the hundreds and maybe hundreds of pages of property detail line items on their returns, and often there's over-reporting where property has been retired and it's no longer in use that has not been removed from the report.
Yeah.
And so we're basing our value on information that the company provides us, which is often has mistakes. And so we're in a process of correcting that with them and working with them. I mean, I do have some data for the last 5 years. The most recent is 2009-10. It's a little confusing because it's all broken down by either accounts or sites or companies. One company might have four plants, and they might have 30 accounts. Some of that is we're building a new building, we purchased new land to expand, a new account is created. So trying to make a little sense of that, in 2009-10, 58 sites were appealed out of the 3,000 some accounts companies. And then 73% of those were sustained at the Board of Property Tax Appeals. 15% were reduced, 3% were dismissed, and 10% were withdrawn. So dismissals and withdrawals typically occur. Dismissals are usually a result of a mistake. Their party is not aggrieved. They filed incorrectly or untimely. A withdrawal is usually a situation where we've worked with the company and they say, there's no outstanding issues. Let's not waste everybody's time. And then 30 ultimately of those 58 are appealed on to the tax court. And I want to correct that by saying about half of the 30 are really not appealed on. They were never appealed to the board in the first place. They elected to go straight. So about approximately 15.
And one last question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you. If we move forward with this change, will there be a request in the next 6 months or a year for another tax court judge to handle the additional workload? And if so, what would that cost be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juan, we have thought about that, and that is a concern, although we think the process that's happening now without the board will occur in the same manner. We will have the discussions with the companies, we'll work through the returns, and we'll talk. Usually it's not a dispute about value, it's a dispute about facts, and we can resolve those. So we don't see that any actual issues of disagreement would proceed that aren't proceeding currently. And if I might add, the first step really at the Tax Court Magistrate Division is case management and mediation. So there's always that beginning process. It's not an automatic trial. We're preparing for a trial right now. It's going to take us about 3 months. The trial will be about a week. There's so much information that a board can't handle that because they're not set up for it. And so the trials are very infrequent.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's helpful. Yes, Representative Eric Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up question. I'm just a concern about those taxpayers that are borderline at the million-dollar threshold. By making this law, how is it then determined for those folks that it's questionable whether or not they are then required to go to magistrate versus the regular appeal process that's currently in place? Those that are questionable, how will that be determined, and will it require a different mechanism that's not currently in place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, if an account is a borderline account or it's just slightly under $1 million and it happens to be handled by the county, and they have a right to go to the Board of Property Tax Appeals because of that, then we would expect that the same kind of thing that occurs now would occur. The board, the assessor's value would likely be sustained. We would continue to work with that. The county would work with that company, and then they'd have the same right of appeal to the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just don't like the answer. Thank you.
Do you want to comment on why?
It's just unclear. What I could see is someone where the value all of a sudden is $1,100,000, and the value is very much what's in discrepancy, and they maybe don't want to go to magistrate. Maybe they don't want to be put into this special $1 million bucket, and all of a sudden now they're forced into a process where maybe they would have preferred a different process. And so that's the only thing, if the value is what's in discrepancy.
Yeah, thank you. I want to go back to the question that Representative Wand asked, and your answer to that about the process again. I'm still interested in trying to figure out how we fit all these pieces together. A taxpayer files an appeal. What do you do? What does your department do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just back up just a little bit and say that roughly October 25th, the tax statements are mailed.
Correct.
From that day until December 31st, they have the right to file an appeal. The appeal then, under current law, if it's to the Board of Property Tax Appeals, then would be processed by the clerk in the county, and hearings begin the first Monday, I think, in February, mm-hmm. and they proceed until April 15th.
Are you involved in that process?
We're involved in that process.
What way?
It was our appraisal.
Correct.
So we would be directly responsible to work with the company and to appear, represent the department in its appraisal, and defend that asserted value.
All right. Well, I want to back up. Do you typically have conversations with the company then about what they object to and what information you've got, and try to clarify and reach an agreement if you can before the board hearing?
Mr. Chair, absolutely, as a matter of course, yes. It's what we do.
Okay. And how is it different, if it is, if a company chooses to elects to go directly to the tax court instead of going through the board?
Mr. Chair, we would continue to work with the company regardless of where the appeal is filed.
Okay.
Because we don't want to go to trial. We don't think that's a good use. Most all the time there are issues that need resolved, and so it behooves both parties to have conversations, and so we do.
And
we settle many, many cases.
Yeah, and do you have a sense that of what percentage of these cases that are resolved by a reduction in the value or in some way the tax or the omission of property that was listed erroneously in the first place or any of those kinds of things by the department rather than at the appeal process level?
If I'm understanding, Mr. Chair, your question...
How many times do you settle for less than what you asked for?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. So
many times we discover property that wasn't part of the initial appraisal and we add the property, so sometimes there's additions and reductions.
Right.
The one thing we don't do in terms of settlement is that we don't negotiate a compromise, if you will, because the law and the Constitution requires that what we do is we agree on what's the real market value, which is a non-negotiable. but at the same time as being non-negotiable, it's also not precise.
Yeah.
So there's a range of value with any appraisal.
And what percentage of the time would you say that through the a process that goes to the board decides to adjust the amount of tax due, and then there's no further appeal? Agreement with the company, but a decision made by one of the local boards.
Mr. Chair, I will tell you that in no case does the board increase the value. I don't believe that the board has the authority to increase the value, but I think maybe the chair might give an indication of your recollection of how often reductions occur.
In this sort of situation
it's
we're talking
very,
about.
Very, very rare.
Very rare.
Because the board is sitting there, even though, as I said, they are fully competent realtors, bankers, whatnot. They haven't had the luxury of time to go through documents this thick to really understand exactly what the issues are. And so they will, we feel very fairly, say, we haven't been able to sit in judgment on these issues as completely as we wish, so we will go ahead and sustain the value so that you can take it on to magistrate or the tax court.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And then what percentage of the time would you say that the after all of the negotiations and discussions and clarifications, the tax court, either at the magistrate level or at the tax judge level, tell you that they're going to side with the taxpayer or at least reduce the values or the whatever the thing is so that the taxes end up being less?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a number for that. It's a little difficult because...
It's seldom, isn't it?
It's very seldom.
Yeah.
We don't go to
Most
trial.
Of the time, if there's an issue of fact, you resolve it in your conversations with the taxpayer rather than at the hearing level.
That's correct.
At any hearing. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I think we're... Oh,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Could I please take the time to thank these ladies for their service on this committee and the work that they do?
Thank you, Representative Berger. I really appreciate your reminding.
And coming down and talking to us.
Yes.
We do appreciate it.
Yeah. It's extremely helpful to work on these kinds of things and make our system work better. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have an assessor with us this morning as well, and I'd like to hear from him next. And is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill this morning? This is the end of the list we have. Bob, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Assessors. And you've actually already pretty thoroughly, I think, talked about the process that takes place when a property is appealed and goes to the Board of Property Tax Appeals, and then what happens next. What I would like to do is clarify anything, if it remains unclarified, to make a couple comments about what was said. I'm very much in agreement that I think that this is a positive step to make the process a little more efficient and effective. You've heard that our boards of property tax appeals are really the first step in the appeal process. And as it was designed, this is a pretty informal step in the process. And what they are being asked to evaluate with these types of properties are probably the most difficult appraisal problems that would really come to a county in general. These are often very special use properties. They're typically or very often multiple accounts, multiple buildings. They often include machinery and equipment and business personal property, as well as land. One thing that I would add is that when one of these appeals does take place, it does bring assessors into the process in that we're still responsible for the valuation of the land. So when a primary or secondary account is appealed, and as these are the accounts we're talking about, the large value accounts, the over million or 5 million in real market value, industrial manufacturing types of properties. When that appeal is made, often there's a tremendous amount of information that needs to be evaluated in order to make a decision. And, you know, typically in Clackamas County, our Board of Property Tax Appeals has about 20 minutes per appeal in order to evaluate the number of appeals that they're going to have from the time period of the first February or the first Monday in February through April 15th when they need to be done and have made decisions. So there's very seldom, and this is really true when it comes to even commercial industrial appeals that the assessor brings to the Board of Property Tax Appeals. Often there is very little time for that board to evaluate all of the information that may come before them. Secondly, because of the informality of the process, oftentimes this information may come to the board on the day of the appeal. It can be brought in by the petitioner. So again, there's seldom sufficient time to actually look at the information that's available and make a decision in the time that they have available. So the Assessors Association supports this bill, and we believe that you know, it won't disadvantage a property owner that has a property of this type, because what we're really looking for is a forum where the information can be shared and a decision can be made either between the parties or with the help of the courts in as efficient and effective time frame as we can make available. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your willingness to take the drive and come down and talk with us. And I suspect, working with the organization that you're involved with, that you'll be back.
We'll be back. And I thank you, Chair Barnhart, and the committee. And I thank Representative Nathanson and for their effort and the effort of the committees to look at these things in an effort to try to streamline our property tax system process. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else want to be heard on House Bill 2478 today? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2478 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2477.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. House Bill 2477 is the second measure that comes from the Government Efficiency Task Force recommendations. And what it does is it eliminates some of the explicit requirements for hard copies and mailings to be done related to certain property tax processes. And it also eliminates the requirement that newspapers be or the notices be published in newspapers of various types of hearings related to taxes.
Thank you. And again, we have the department and Business Oregon and the assessor from Clackamas County. Were there anyone else that you wanted, Mr. Phillips? Okay. I am surprised that the Statesman Journal isn't signed up to testify.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Policy and Planning Division Administrator at Business Oregon, and I served on the Governor's Efficiency Task Force. I have to tell you that when the Assessment and Taxation Subcommittee heard from the department and the assessors, about ways to make the system more efficient. This idea was on the top of everybody's list. There are lots, as I understand it, very antiquated parts of the ORS that govern the property tax system that require posting of materials back in the days when you took the piece of paper and nailed it to the front door of the city hall, like that kind of requirement. And so I think that you'll find that most of the items that are covered in 2477 don't eliminate the opportunity to make written published notice, but allow other kinds of notice. Many of you at the table, right, have computers in front of you. This would allow you to get notice via email. Doesn't require it, doesn't mandate it, doesn't prohibit anybody from doing it in another way. But in an environment where every level of government is struggling to be cost efficient and effective, it removes requirements like certified mail and allows for things like regular first class mail. It allows for electronic publication of notice when a recipient has identified that they can receive notice that way. And so this is one that for me is like so crystal clear that it allows the use of appropriate technology in an environment where most people have more and more access to that technology and doesn't prohibit or prevent additional notice happening in standard published ways. And so it's my hope that you all see this as clearly as we do and make recommendation for it to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And we think this bill, actually, what it does is it amends 10 different statutes that deal with first-class mail, certified mail, registered mail, mass mailings, newspaper publications, and the like. And we think that that at all times, we as government should be looking at inefficiencies, redundancies, and ineffective practices, and this is one of those times, especially now, when we should be doing that. There's a very a good bill, actually, by some distinguished legislators offered this session, House Bill 2321, which would say that if you had an electronic email address for someone, that you could send it to them rather than mailing it to them. I think Representative Barnhart, you were and Representative Reed, you're on that
committee's up
bill.
For hearing. Yeah. That bill is up for hearing next week in the General Government Committee.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this bill is in keeping with the concepts embodied in that bill also. I have a section-by-section analysis, which I'd be happy to go through because it is many and varied, and the issues, do cover a wide variety. So if you're up for that.
It is a complex bill, and I think it would be helpful for the members to and it's fairly fat. I mean, not for Bill in this committee, but still, 12 pages.
Yes.
But why don't you go ahead and do that?
Okay, Mr. Chair, in Section 1 of the bill, this statute is 308225, and it deals with making sure that everyone who is in a district is taxed and everyone that the district for whom it has property in gets the money. And this all evolves around the word boundary change. So if a government has a boundary, then people within the boundary should pay that tax, and people outside the boundary should not. And so all of the boundaries go through this little funnel, and it comes to the department. We review the boundary change like an annexation or a merger, consolidation, or a dissolution. We review the boundary changes that effectuate those legal actions, and we make sure that the lines start in one place and end at that same place, that a property is in or out. We send the notice of our approval by mail to the assessor and to the affected local government, and we think that could be done by email or some other source. So what we're interested in this section is to say, look, you require us to notice them, and we want to be sure that they're noticed, but leave the method to what happens to be the most efficient, and maybe that's electronic. That's the concept in Section 1. Section 2 requires the department to produce, print, distribute personal property tax returns, and then forward them to all counties. We have about, this year, 176,000 personal property returns that we produce, print, pay for, and bulk ship to or hand deliver to counties. The counties then turn around and send those to all small businesses that have personal property, like a roofing business or a you know, whatever kind of small business it is.
Psychology business.
Psychology, Quiznos, yes. And so then that's all sent out. That costs about $90,000 a year to send those out, not counting staff time. And the proposal in Section 2 and 3 would be to just allow those to be accessed through our website. We have the form on our website. It's on many of all county websites, and it's available, it's printable, it's downloadable, and it's fillable.
Representative Burke.
These are the forms. It's like tax forms. It just is authorized.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, so you're just, instead of printing them and sending them,
Please go ahead.
I want to take this section by section if you don't mind.
Yeah, I do. I agree. Yeah,
if a taxpayer says, I don't have a computer, I don't do a computer, how do they get their forms?
Madam Chair, they're available in the county offices.
Here's what bothers me a little bit about this, and I'm not necessarily objecting. It's the guy who, I'm one of them. I don't know to pay it until I get the bill. That's my signal to pay, is that bill that comes in some form. So if they're not online, and they don't get the bill in the mail, how do they know to pay? And the forms are, in essence, is the reminder.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, what I thought about when I was thinking about that question ahead of time was our income tax form.
I knew you had.
And that's a good question. I mean, I think all of us know that there's something about April 15th that's drawing near, and
yeah.
We need to do something. And what that something is find a return somewhere and fill it out and send it in. The practice in the past was to mail the income tax booklet to, 1.5 million taxpayers in Oregon. The practice now is to...
A postcard.
I'm sorry?
They send a postcard.
We do send a postcard for last year's taxes, and that's a reminder. But we also do not send a booklet out to anyone who file electronically. So that is kind of the changing Department of Revenue processing to accommodate the new technology. And that's what we're moving forward with. We're attempting to move forward with personal property return. We think people have a sense that they need to file. They have access to the forms. We can provide paper forms. We think that they will find the form or we'll send it to them.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, please. Yeah.
I guess in looking at this, I would like some serious consideration to a heads-up system telling people there's, if this passes, that there's going to be changes and some sort, because, and I get it, that if they file electronically, they're probably pretty cool with it, but a lot of people just aren't there yet, and I worry that they then... get a liability because they just didn't get it, that it's change, and then the fines are high, and
Chair Barnhart?
Yeah, please.
For the record, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Assessors. I think that there are a couple of considerations here. You're absolutely right in that we would continue to have to be able to provide paper forms to property owners that may not have access to a computer. What's happening today is really a number of things, and you started just now to talk about that. I think that there will be a significant move towards filing this type of return more and more on an electronic basis. Secondly, what we've done at Clackamas County, and I believe most counties do as a matter of practice, is make a real outreach effort to tax preparation professionals, because these people typically have that access. They're the ones that are typically preparing these forms for property owners, not all, but
but most. And that's where we found that the idea of compliance is best made. It's to those people that it's really to their benefit to be of a service to their clients, which are the taxpayers. So that's a second thing that's happening. I think a third thing to consider is that we mail these forms out the end of December. And there's really some concern about by March whether people still have them if they've received them and they aren't calling us or contacting us and asking us to send another form. Also, John mentioned that in our office, and again, I think it's probably pretty consistent around the state, we make links available and printable forms available not only on our website but through the state and the Department of Revenue. So the idea, I think, in this area and with most areas is not either to eliminate access to any of these types of forms or reduce the amount of notice that we're going to provide people, because that's crucial. But what we want to do is move into a better way of processing, a more efficient and a more effective way of doing it.
So are you saying that the department or the assessors are going to make electronic filing available for this information form?
Right now, and again, I think there will be some discussion because we will be having some discussion on electronic signatures and the appropriateness of those for these types of forms at some point. But Linn County, I believe, has already started a pilot project, where they are doing electronic filing. At Clackamas County, we're seriously looking at it from the standpoint that our system has that capability. There's a module for our system that would allow this, and we think that it would be a much more efficient and effective way to do it. So I think that is coming in the future. It will be over a period of time that this will occur, and I think that as we move towards this, there are certainly ways where we can advise personal property owners, especially from the county perspective, when we mail a tax statement. If we are going to make a change of this type, we can make sure that we inform those people not only on their tax statement, but with a tax statement that's coming out in a prior year, we can begin to make this information available about changes that could be coming down the line. And then I know that we would be doing certainly some outreach within our own county, and I expect that this would take place in all counties to let people know that this process is occurring and what options a property owner may have.
Mr. Chair, additionally, we put out press releases twice before the filing season, so that anybody reading the paper would have a sense of, you know, that the time is coming, you need to file. And as little as I pay to public notices in the newspaper, I often see those things. And maybe I'm more aware of it, but just there it is, and I think, oh, I don't have to file this year.
Why don't we go ahead and quickly go through the other items on the on your information. I will note that what this provision does is simply remove the language that that requires a mailing, and in that language it already says that failure to receive or secure the form does not relieve the person or management agent or officer from the obligation of making any return required by the section. So while you're required to mail it under the current law, even if they don't receive it, they're still required to file a return. Go ahead.
That's correct. Section 4, this statute requires the department to publish a notice that's printed in the state capitol. This is a carryover from original legislation in 1909 that had the Department of Revenue essentially providing notice of some tentative and uncertain information. We assess all utility property, which is railroad and airlines, and we work with those companies, and by June 15th we say, here is our thoughts about what your value might be. Come talk to us. And in order, and then the department's director from June 15th to August 1st is supposed to sit and listen to those and make corrections. And this notice is published 3 weekly, newspapers printed in the state capitol and of things that aren't certain and are possibly not going to come to pass. To us, it's more effective to know what the actual values are. Typically, we meet then with those companies that have questions about our values all summer long, work those things out, and then we'll send the final values to the assessors in, which is all public information. So,
how many companies are there in that category? Are we talking about a dozen?
It varies, Mr. Chair, from 300 to 500. We're talking about, well, we think we're talking about communications companies. We're talking about railroads, airlines, gas, electric,
utilities.
Utilities.
Okay.
The cost is not unbelievably high. It's about $1,800 a year, but no one in our collective recollection has ever appeared.
Okay.
Section 5.
It works really well then, doesn't it?
Very effective. Section 5 conforms changes in another statute to the one in Section 4, so that's just conforming changes. Section 6 and 7, these deal with two programs that are in the sort of rural tract area where people have what's called open space land. It's specially assessed, or what we would call riparian land in the law, and it gives them a special assessed value, and they get a series of notices, but this is kind of carryover language from a long time ago where the assessor could send a letter, and it's a demand. It's a demand upon the person to prove that they're still using the property in the way that the statute requires for the special assessment. And so I don't think this happens very often. The assessors are out looking at property, and they'll just talk to people, or they'll send them a letter saying, should we be disqualifying your property, and then they have a conversation. So we're not sure that certified and registered mail is the best way to effectuate that communication.
And the change still requires some mailing, doesn't it?
Change requires mailing, yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Oh, Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a statutory provision that says that something is deemed received some number of days after it's mailed? Is that now what you're going to rely upon in measuring the 90 days in Section 6 and Section 7?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, I believe this is the date that they receive it, and there is a statute in Chapter 305 that says that receipt is determined by proof satisfactory to the addressee, and in this case, it's the assessor. And so there is a process, and we've encouraged counties to have a policy about what is proof satisfactory. So that could be, we've got a cancellation. We keep an affidavit of the things we mail out, which is what counties would do on their end. We have the canceled date stamp from the post office. And then they come in and with explanations, and Bob can speak to this about the people that come in terms of how you talk about what you did. I put it in the mail. This is the day I did it. And then the county kind of sets out standards that say, well, if they can tell us this and show us that, then we'll accept it.
Please.
We've been through this many times, and of course, to short-circuit the innumerable arguments about having not received regular mail, we send it both ways, because many times folks won't claim the certified mail. But oddly enough, the regular mail doesn't come back. It's just
yeah.
So I'm just interested if this truly will end up saving time, and I guess it depends upon the circumstance, because a certified receipt solves a lot of difficult proof.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, I think I was told that about $5.80 for certified mail, and then when you get a certified letter from the assessor, what are you going to do with it? You know, a lot of people don't touch it. They don't want to touch it or sign it or open. So first-class mail, we send refunds through first-class mail. They seem to be cashed. We send
people,
the tax
people
statement,
cash their checks. Huh?
And we also send the tax statement by regular mail. So.
Yes, Representative Wan.
I have an overarching concern with the concept of this bill, which is that these notice
provisions in these notice statutes and the method of providing for delivery have been set up with the mindset of ensuring that the person that we intend to receive the mail is most likely to actually receive it. And we form those policy decisions over generations, relying upon the U.S. Postal Service and the fact that it's very difficult for people to pick up and move their things, and that that isn't something that happens nearly as frequently as people changing their email addresses. And so my overarching concern, sorry, that's a long comment, but my overarching concern is that what we're focusing in on with this bill is efficiency and cost, and that we haven't given enough thought to ensuring notice is actually received. And in particular, Representative Bentz, I think, raises a key point here, which is that there is an evidentiary rule in court that if you properly address and deposit a letter in the mail, the person you addressed it to and paid the proper postage is presumed at law to have received it. There is no corresponding presumption in the evidentiary law for emails. And so I think that we're certainly on the cutting edge here. And I'm not saying that I'm opposing this bill, but I have some real concerns about this, making sure that we don't have an exception that defeats the purpose of the general rule.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, and this section does provide for first-class mail. It does not just say shall notify. It's on page 9. And in line 26.
Yeah, and there's several sections like this that remove the requirement for a registered or certified and instead insert first class.
Yeah, sections 6, 7, and 9 do that.
Yeah.
And there are other opportunities. There's a statute, 305-280, which says that any person can file with an appeal for any act of the assessor or the tax collector. They also have their tax statement, which they can appeal. If there's the assessor was adding information that was inappropriate, that they can appeal that and challenge it. So we think there's some adequate.
You know, it's interesting. We all get certified mail occasionally for a whole variety of reasons. I think the last one I got was the last time somebody suggested that we should hold a special session, and the clerk's required to send out a letter by certified mail. It was a hassle because the postman and I had to get together at the same time for me to even receive it. My suspicion is that first-class mail is more likely to actually be received and read than a certified letter is, for whatever that's worth.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I would tend to agree. And I think, again, I wanted to reiterate that, you know, the intent of this this bill is not to reduce the amount of notice. We want to notice people. We want to make sure people that get notice. We want to do it in the most effective and efficient way. And certainly in Clackamas County, if you don't consider our mailing cost for tax statements and trimesters, about 50% of our cost of mailing is a result of mailing certified types of notifications. And it's really the effectiveness that we question, because we find typically that people are responding to the first class mail.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and see if we can finish this one up.
Section 8, Mr. Chair, deals with Chapter 309025, which is in the Board of Property Tax Appeals area, which we just discussed at length on the previous bill. And this is a notice to the general public of the time and place of the board's meetings. This is just a general notice published in the newspaper that says the board's going to start meeting. That meeting time and date is the meeting date is established in law already, similar to your meetings, established in law, and says the board will meet in the first month, beginning on the first Monday, and everyone who is got an issue before the board gets a specific notice. So we thought that the general publication in the newspaper of the beginning of the board was a bit redundant, and to people that may not, maybe the wrong audience.
When you send the tax statement, it includes the person's a statement of the right of appeal and how one perfects that, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, on the back of the tax statement, that's all
correct.
Detailed,
it's
yes.
So you're on notice that there is such a thing as a board and that there is a right to appeal.
Exactly.
And how to do it.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 9 deals with the same issues of certified versus first-class mail that we discussed in Section 6 and 7, and that is for property that the assessor discovers and says, I wonder why this isn't on the tax rolls. You built a barn. It's not on our records. You didn't have it last year, and they send the notice. It's the second of three notices that are sent, and for some reason that second notice is sent certified, and again, we would suggest it be sent by regular mail, first class. Section 10 deals with a rarely occurring event. It's in Chapter 311, and it's a situation where a local government passes a levy for a specific purpose. They've built the building or purchased the equipment, and they've got levy money left over, and they don't have authority to spend it on anything else, and they want to refund it. For some reason, the requirement exists in law to publish that in a newspaper of general circulation in the county. And then following that, the assessor and treasurer, I guess, tax collector, would then mail refunds to all affected people. So the people that are affected, that are really entitled to this money back that they paid in excess of the actual amount needed, they will get their refund. And all of the other people might read it in the newspaper and call. But we're just not sure why there's this general notice.
How often do we do that?
I think it's very rare. Have you ever done it?
I can't think of the last time in 25 years.
Mr. Chair, Section 11 deals with the forest land values. The Department of Revenue sets the forest land values by class, so if it's really highly producing forest land, it gets a certain value every year. Lower producing, lower year. Lower value. So we set the values. We do this by administrative rules. We have a public hearing. Sometimes someone will show up. Usually Oregon Forest Industries Council will show up. And this statute allows five or more interested persons together. There has to be five. And they can file an appeal and challenge the value. The issue in this section that deals with what we're changing here is that once they've done that, then we have to send, the Department of Revenue has to send out, in the manner of personal service, I'm reading on line 37 of page 11, in the manner of personal service, certified mail to each taxpayer affected. Now, those are taxpayers affected in the single land market, and there's five single land markets in Oregon, one for eastern Oregon and four in the valley. So we're talking about maybe hundreds of thousands of notices here to people who might be affected. It's kind of like the department saying, hey, by the way, you might be included in a class. I think if the appeal, I mean, I know that if the appeal is successful, then the values will be changed and it will affect everybody. But we would rather, we think it's more effective and more efficient use of our resources for the state here to say, let's work with the people that own the forest land, like the industries, like Forest Industries Council, Small Woodlands Association, and say, hey, by the way, can we get this a notice out in your newsletter? And we can do that. In this section, it says, in line 39 on page 11, the manner prescribed by the department by rule. So in a rules process, we would be talking with those kinds of folks that are affected and work out a reasonable notification.
Yeah.
Section 12 just gives you an effective date, and that's the end.
Right. In 11... nobody's ever going to ask for the assessment to go up, are they? Because the people who can appeal are the ones who actually own property.
In our collective memory, we've not had an appeal.
Well, this doesn't happen.
Because I don't recall this happening since one person said maybe back in the late 70s.
Okay. Other questions, comments on for this panel? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2477? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2477 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2205. Mazin.
Thank you. Good job.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, co-vice chairs,
vice co-chairs.
Can you give us a little explanation of this bill?
And do, sir.
And do we have a witness list? We do. Thank you.
The House Bill 2205 comes to you from the State Treasurer and the Oregon Facilities Authority. Just to give you a quick background, Oregon Facilities Authority is an entity that allows for nonprofits to use the the credit rating of the state of Oregon, use that through the state treasurer to make bonds or sell bonds that are at less than would have been the case if they go by themselves to the market. So it allows them the good credit for the state. However, this is not does not obligate the state for the payments of the bonds. And this bill, what it tries to do, the Oregon Facility Authority come to you almost every session with trying to improve their processes. What this bill tries to do is allow for that process to be offered for projects that are not whole or wholly to be held in Oregon. So some of them will be outside the state. So this is the idea of this bill, how the state treasurer and the Oregon Facilities Authority are working on the details of what and how would be eligible for this bill is obviously still being worked with amendments and so on that we don't have at this point, but they're here to describe these things to you and put the whole bill and concept in perspective for your policy consideration.
Great. Thank you. And it looks to me as though the Treasurer's Office has a panel. Why don't you, whoever's planning to come, why don't you come forward and present your testimony. Mr. Salaggio, good.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I'm bringing to you 2205, which would help finance certain nonprofit projects at no cost to the state. I'll allow my more learned colleagues to go over the mechanics of this bill, but as staff mentioned, we do have a set of amendments that's currently making its way through Legislative Council. These amendments make only several technical changes, but also fine-tune what kinds of projects are and are not eligible for this type of financing. I'm going to quickly turn this over to Gwen Griffith, the Executive Director of the Facilities Authority, and with the leave of the committee, I'm going to vacate my seat for Ms. Sharon Banks of Cascade Sarah Solutions, one of the potential beneficiaries of this legislation.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to catch you up to date on what's going on at the Oregon Facilities Authority, Oregon's tiniest state agency. Someone told me last night, OFA is easy to love, and what they meant was it helps nonprofits. But the real reason it's easy to love is that it doesn't cost the state a dime, and we're not here to ask for any money. OFA is a state agency that has a sole mission of helping nonprofits. When a nonprofit wants to buy a facility or build a facility or perhaps remodel, and it wants to borrow money to do that, then it can work with us and the Office of State Treasurer to significantly lower its interest expense. The way we do that at OFA is that we work with nonprofits that are interested in the program and make sure that they're eligible under our rules and the federal rules, because all of our bonds are governed by federal tax law. We work with them, they make an application to OFA, we review that application, and we recommend to the State Treasurer's Office
whether or not to issue a bond. Ultimately, it is the state treasurer's decision to issue or not issue a bond. And the bond is a tax-exempt bond so that the interest is exempt from federal and Oregon state income tax. That's why it can have a lower rate of interest. These bonds are not guaranteed by the state of Oregon. The state's credit rating is not at risk for them. The investors are looking solely to the nonprofit for repayment of the bond. OFIS bonds range in size from $500,000 for the Camelot Theater in Talent, Oregon, to upwards of $300 million for Peace Health Riverbend Project in Springfield. We, in this biennium, have issued, through the State Treasurer's Office, over $530 million of OFA bonds for 18 different nonprofits.
Over what period of time?
This biennium. Mm-hmm. An example of one of our nonprofits is right here in Salem, in the Northwest Human Services. It provides low-cost dental, mental health, and medical services to low-income Oregonians. It borrowed $1.8 million in our OFA SNAP bond program to buy its administrative building and remodel its West Salem clinic. In doing so, it saved significantly in its interest expense, and it is able to take that savings to its bottom line to serve more Oregonians and to continue to employ the 168 people that work there. OFA's borrowers are diverse, but what we're dealing with in this session is the increasing tendency of our large borrowers to be working in multiple states. They may be here. A hospital system, for example, may have a hospital here, but also in Idaho, in Washington, and Alaska. Or one of our colleges may want to open a professional school elsewhere. Ms. Banks will talk to us about how her agency works in lots of different states, all 50, I believe. And our problem that we're seeing in our statute is that it's just not clear whether OFA has the authority to issue out-of-state projects. With it being unclear, I doubt I could recommend to our board to issue in such a situation. But we also noticed in looking at this that there is a potential problem with the income tax exemption, the Oregon income tax exemption. The income tax exemption, in our view, should be limited to projects within the state of Oregon. If a project is outside our state, the income tax exemption for Oregon should not extend to bond proceeds for that project. So we would want to bifurcate an issuance and really issue a series for Oregon and a series for out-of-state projects. The out-of-state project would not enjoy the Oregon income tax exemption. This bill remedies both those problems. It clarifies OFA's ability to issue outside the state, and it also eliminates the Oregon income tax exemption for out-of-state bond proceeds. Mike Schrader of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, our authority bond counsel, is here for any questions that you might have on the specifics of the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions. May we hear from Sharon Banks, Mr.
Please.
Chair?
Please, and welcome to the Capitol. I really appreciated the tour that I had of your facility several months ago, and we're very glad to see you today.
Thank you, and thank you for listening.
And would you state your name for the record and then give your testimony?
Yes. My name is Sharon Banks. I'm the CEO of Cascade Sierra Solutions. Our organization is a nonprofit organization with a mission to save fuel and reduce emissions from the trucking industry. We have grown very, very quickly in our 4 years of existence to becoming a commercial lender, breaking down the capital cost barrier for companies to get equipment on their trucks that can save a significant amount of fuel. Saving fuel not only reduces climate change issues, it saves money for the trucking entity and it also reduces diesel particulate emissions, which are toxic human health carcinogens. So we call it a everybody wins. It's an everybody wins type project. Our access to capital has been put together first by getting a loan from the Oregon Department of Energy and then from Oregon DOT, and then we've put together pretty much cobbled together a group of different facilities from local banks and credit unions and other facilities to try to keep up with the demand for our program. We have had an enormous amount of growth in the 4 years that we've been in existence, and to be quite honest, the banks are not keeping up with our demand, and we need to be able to access capital in larger amounts and with lower costs of funds. So we would enjoy having the ability to work with OFA. There are other states that will issue bonds for Cascade Sierra, but we'd really like to keep the business here. And even though there are, you know, we do put equipment on trucks that come through the state, there's a great benefit to Oregon because a lot of time those projects are installed right here, and those are providing jobs for our local dealers and providers of installation services.
Could you tell us why you have such a demand for credit? I think I'm asking a little bit about your business model.
Right. Our business model, we have a lot of demand for our services. Not only do we provide loans to trucking companies, but we also help bring in incentives. Right now we have incentives from the National Department of Energy that will subsidize the cost about 20% on fuel on items to improve fuel efficiency. We also have grants from a number of different states that provide grants for upgrading and completely replacing trucks. And there's a huge benefit. Some of our projects, we have data that shows that we've been able to save more than 30% of the fuel by designing a project correctly and making sure they have the right truck for the job.
Okay. So you need access to capital in order to make those loans.
Right.
And then your stream to repay comes from the trucking companies themselves.
And in most cases, they'll save more money from the fuel savings on the project than what the payment is for them to repay. So it's very easy for them to repay.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Yep. I'm losing my voice. It's getting worse. Are you a nonprofit?
Yes.
Is there anyone else in the state doing this kind of work?
No. In fact, in the whole country, there's nobody that does the same thing we do.
You have a monopoly, huh?
Well, at the moment. And we're hoping, actually, to encourage others to do the same because there's a huge demand that, I mean, we've gone from the first year we did about $3 million worth of business, and last year we did about $60 million worth of business. And this year our budget is going to be about $126 million. And we're also going to hire 25 more people in Oregon. So that's the growth curve that we're on and we've been on for the last few years.
Okay, thank you. And did you have some testimony that you wanted to give, or you're just here to offer information?
Just here to answer questions.
All right, so let's get back then to the more general questions. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Ms. If I were on the floor of the House and picked this thing up, and it says authorized issuance of pass-through revenue bonds to finance projects outside the state, I'd be voting no before I even got to the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly do you mean by that?
Under the Oregon Facilities Authority, Mike Schrader, bond counsel with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe. Under the Oregon Facilities Authority statute, as Ms. Griffith mentioned, the authority is charged working through the treasurer's office with issuing the authority to issue tax-exempt revenue bonds for nonprofits. What we have in the case, and the Cascade Sierra case is an example of that, is we have a nonprofit that's based in Oregon, clearly an Oregon company, Oregon jobs, and here a very uniquely Oregon mission.
Stop.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm getting real tired of something that's just ringing bells in my ear. I go back to my question, are you a company or are you a nonprofit? Because in my mind, there's a difference.
Nonprofit.
Thank you.
A 501c3 nonprofit.
And in fact, under this section of the statute, of the federal authorization, it has to be a nonprofit.
It does. It does. The tax-exempt financing that the Facilities Authority implements is tax federal tax exemption for interest on tax exempt bonds issued through the state for the benefit of nonprofits. So you have to be a 501c3, and our role as bond counsel to the state is to ensure that the nonprofit qualifies for tax exempt financing under the federal code, and then in addition that it fits within the parameters of the authorization to issue revenue bonds through the Oregon Facilities Authority through the Treasurer's Office. So what we have in this case is we have an Oregon nonprofit with a mission in the case of Cascade Sierra, as our example, and there's other examples as well, an Oregon-based nonprofit who is financing facilities or programs that are not just in Oregon. In the case of Cascade Sierra, they make loans to the truck owner-operators in multiple states. But again, you have an Oregon-based nonprofit with operations in service centers in Washington, Oregon, and California on the I-5 corridor. So their ability to access tax-exempt financing through the Facilities Authority right now is simply not clear in terms of their ability to access tax-exempt bond financing through the authority, because those proceeds are being loaned both to owner-operators in Oregon and also in Washington and California and other states. Currently, the statute is unclear as to whether we can issue bonds for the benefit of Cascade Sierra. Similar example Ms. Griffith mentioned, in the event we have an Oregon higher education institution who may have a campus in Oregon, but also a campus in Idaho or across the river in Vancouver, for example, in Washington. Currently, it's not clear whether they could issue bonds to finance anything other than an Oregon project.
Yeah, please.
Okay. Do we have campuses across the river? Is that an example, or is that?
It is.
In other words,
there is a nonprofit higher education institution in the state who has issued bonds through the Facilities Authority, who is opening a campus in Idaho currently.
Okay, so how many others? How big is this universe of affected nonprofits?
We don't know how many it is. I mean, certainly Cascade Sierra is an example of a unique example of an Oregon nonprofit with multiple state operations. We certainly have, in the case of one higher education institution who's borrowed through the Facilities Authority, has an out-of-state, is opening an out-of-state campus. And certainly in the case of all of our healthcare, all of our large healthcare providers in the state, they have multiple hospital systems. Some senior living companies as well will operate facilities in multiple states as well. This bill would
authorize this bond issuance to those folks for facilities like in Vancouver or something?
Sure. It would.
Through the Oregon Facilities Authority.
So in the current case, if you're for example, you're a healthcare provider and you have Oregon facilities and Washington facilities, currently you have to issue, if you've got a Washington project and an Oregon project, you have to issue your bonds, one through the Washington Authority, one through the Oregon Authority, to issue your tax-exempt bonds for both of those projects. This would allow that, in my example, a healthcare institution to nonprofit to issue bonds for both projects through the Oregon Facilities Authority. Now, as Ms. Griffith mentioned, I think this is important to underscore, in the event this bill were to pass and bonds would be issued by the Oregon facilities for two projects, one in Oregon and one in Washington, the federal tax exemption, of course, applies to both, but the bonds would be bifurcated so that the personal income tax exemption for interest would only be available, as it currently is, only for the Oregon project, and the statute clarifies, the amendments clarify, that there would be no tax exemption, no state tax exemption for the Washington-financed project.
Representative Berger, go ahead, and then we'll have Representative
Daley. Is that what the bill does, clarify that piece?
Yes.
Or does, I mean, does it clarify or does it allow?
It clarifies. Currently 289 provides currently that the Facilities Authority can finance programs for nonprofits in Oregon. And it says nonprofits in Oregon. So the language of the statute currently is that the Facilities Authority can issue revenue bonds for nonprofits in Oregon. So if you have a nonprofit that's in Oregon, like Cascade Sierra, clearly in Oregon, Oregon-based, Oregon operations, you can issue those revenue bonds. There's no geographic limit on the project that you can finance if you are a company in Oregon. So this statute clarifies what it means to be a company in Oregon and expressly provides that that company, if it is based in Oregon, it can finance projects that projects in addition to projects located in the state of Oregon. The facilities
using the bonds through
this authority. That's what the statute says. Currently, we've never had a situation where we've had a nonprofit who has come to the Facilities Authority and requested that. I think, again, in Cascade and other institutions that we've described, there's clearly a potential to do that now. We want to make sure that the statute and the Facilities Authority have the ability to continue to assist and support Oregon-based nonprofits.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have exactly the same questions that Chair Berger had, but I'm still confused, so I'm going to ask them in a different way.
No problem.
Thank you.
Again.
It's my goal.
And I think this perhaps relates to the fact that if I'm starting to understand correctly, that this bill does a couple of different things, and that what we're starting to mix a little bit of the answers here on what it does.
Okay.
So I guess I have a series of questions. One, so this bill clarifies an ambiguity, is that correct? And whereas before it was not clear whether or not an institution had the ability to issue these bonds to support a facility outside of the state, is that right?
That's correct.
And then after clarification, it bifurcates whether the bonds are taxable or not taxable based on the location of that facility.
Oregon taxable.
But Oregon taxable.
Correct.
Okay. So is it the case now with this bill that an entity, it seems that there are two things necessary for it to be taxable. One, that the institution is, that the receiving nonprofit or institution is located within the state, and that the project has to be within the state. Is that correct?
Okay. What it will require now in terms of being an eligible borrower and project under the statute as it's proposed to be amended, to be an eligible borrower, the borrower has to be an Oregon nonprofit. And there's a definition in here of what a nonprofit within the state, what that means. That means they're building a project here, they're based here, they have significant operations here. So that's what we call the nexus. That's the Oregon nexus. So to be an eligible borrower, you have to be an Oregon-based you have to satisfy that nexus of being an Oregon entity.
Okay. Yes, please.
So that, I think, now gets to the question. So in order to be an eligible borrower, you have to have, you have to be located within Oregon, and you have to have at least one project that's happening in Oregon. But if you have another project that's outside of Oregon, you can use this this pass-through revenue bond to finance that project. It's just taxable for state purposes.
It would be taxable for state purposes. The test in terms of your eligibility to borrow under the Facilities Authority statute is to be an Oregon nonprofit, and that's the definition of what it means to be a nonprofit or a participating institution within the state. That gets you the qualification to borrow through the Facilities Authority. At that point, then you look at the project that's being financed, and then you've got to, you track through, and there's a detailed definition of what eligible projects are, and then the geography of the project will determine whether the project is
Oregon tax exempt or not Oregon tax exempt. If it's Oregon, if the project in Oregon, it's Oregon tax exempt. If it's not in Oregon, it's not Oregon tax exempt.
Yep, please, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just to make sure that I'm absolutely clear on this, if you are, so the statement at the beginning says authorizes issuance of pass-through revenue bonds to finance projects outside this state. It's not entirely accurate, it sounds like. What this bill does is it clarifies that ability, creates the bifurcation, and so in a scenario in which you are an entity located in Oregon but only financing projects out of state, would you be an eligible borrower?
You, the way it's drafted currently, you could finance a project if you, for example, if you were a higher education institution and you were building a campus in Vancouver, you could issue through the Facilities Authority. But again, you would have to be an Oregon participating institution to finance those to issue those revenue bonds for that project. There's not a requirement that you have a partnering project in Oregon. Because, for example, a healthcare institution typically will issue bonds for a variety of projects across a variety of facilities for a large system. This would not constrain, and you might be in front of the Facilities Authority in 1 year or later in the same year or perhaps the next year. And so we didn't want to dictate in the statute whether the participating institution basically dictate a capital plan or a financing plan. We wanted to be able to provide the ability to provide that service and support to those nonprofits regardless of where their particular capital plan, how the sequence, how their capital plan was sequenced.
Final follow-up?
Please, yes.
So then just, again, to be clear, it is not the case then that if you are an institution located outside of Oregon for whatever reason, a North Carolina institution comes to Oregon and wants to use this financing method, even though it's taxable, to build something in North Carolina, that would not be eligible?
Absolutely not. In fact, that's a very big difference between what the clarifying legislation that's being proposed for the Oregon Facilities Authority and, frankly, what's occurring in a number of other states right now where you can simply go shop for an issuer in another state. That is not the case here. There's a very clear nexus to have an Oregon nexus. The company has to be an Oregon-based, or the project has to be here in Oregon to do that. The objective here is to support Oregon nonprofits, not to be an issuer who can issue in any other jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Walsh.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will apologize now. I will tell you that I will do it again.
And it'll be okay next time, too.
Thank you.
You've used two terms that give me a little bit of concern, issuing bonds and using Oregon's credit. So I just want to confirm for the record here that these are non-recourse to the state of Oregon.
These are non-recourse to the state of Oregon. Oregon does not guarantee the repayment of these bonds. And if they're issued in the public market, it's the credit of the borrower or it's bank backing, not Oregon's credit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eric Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I have a couple questions. One is you're talking about the nexus of the organization to the state of Oregon, but one of the OR clause, the last one under Section C, says is owned by or affiliated under common ownership with an institution described in B, which B is primary place of business. Being familiar with how convoluted some of these entities can become, affiliated under common ownership leaves a lot of wiggle room for somebody to come shopping for an Oregon bond. So can you address that?
The intent there is simply to accommodate a situation where you've got an Oregon nonprofit who has created a separate entity as the borrowing entity for a project. It's not designed to, you know, have some loose affiliation. It's common control, control of the board. It's designed truly for a corporate affiliate where you've simply created a separate entity as a borrowing entity.
Truly understanding and agreeing your heart with this, the affiliation under common ownership, though, is somewhat loose to me and does allow, by design, an opportunity for an entity to somehow, unless it's other defined somewhere else that I'm not sure of, but that is an excellent question that Representative Bailey brought up about that, and that I had the same concern because I do believe this language does leave some loose opportunity there. I want to also clarify that this is talking, when you're talking about the recipient of the interest income having a tax exclusion on Oregon projects only, it says eligible projects located in the state of Oregon. So I want to clarify that the term eligible projects only talks about facilities and does not get into being able to use these funds for operational purposes, or is there some kind of where it can transcend into operations of the facilities as well? Or is it truly just for the cost of acquiring or building the facilities? How does that
work? Your federal tax exempt for your federal tax exemption, it has to be a capital project. So we're talking in almost all situations, we're talking about bricks and mortar equipment and those kinds of things. Let me add let me take that one step further. What we have in the case of Cascade Sierra Solutions is a very unique situation, because what you're ultimately using bond proceeds for is to finance, not acquire directly, but to finance trucks and equipment through the nonprofit, through the making of loans and leases. So in that case, you're actually financing a program that's financing capital assets. But in no event are facilities authority bonds issued to finance working. These are not working capital financings. These are financing capital assets, either directly or indirectly.
So facilities, because I also have one other area of question too. So facilities then isn't necessarily bricks and mortar. It can actually be capital assets such as the trucks as well.
Yes.
And how are capital assets defined then for this purpose?
Capital assets are defined for these purposes. I mean, there's detailed definitions within the eligible program and in the statute itself. But the ability and the purpose you want to use the facilities authority and issue these bonds is for the federal tax exemption and the state tax exemption that follows, as we've talked about. In order to do that, you have to have a capital project. That's all driven by the federal tax code.
As they define capital then.
Right.
And then one follow-up question on the exclusion of interest income. Typically, on municipal interest, it's excluded from any state as both the state or its municipalities underneath the state, and also the U.S. territories, so which could be D.C. conceivably, or Guam, or who knows what. But in this particular case, sounds mostly like you're mentioning only Western states, but have you given thought to this seems to just be only U.S. interest, Oregon interest, but what about if we were to finance something in a U.S. territory such as D.C., which is possible?
Well, again, these are bonds issued by the state of Oregon, so what we are concerned with, those obligations are state tax exempt, again, only to the extent they're financing a project in Oregon. So in terms of that personal income tax exemption, or the state income tax exemption, is going to be driven by who your bond purchasers are and whether they have Oregon income tax liability. Is that responsive, or did I miss the?
I think that there's a U.S. constitutional, and I don't know who would check that on exclusion of interest, and that's a technical question, perhaps. That we might need to look at.
We're getting head nods. They'll look into it.
Yeah, to look into that for U.S. territories exclusion as well. And I'm done. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're getting close to the question, and this has a somewhat familiar ring to it. And we had an issue involving, I hope it wasn't the Bessie, but I can't really remember, and it had to do with trucks that drove in and out of Oregon. And this has a similarity that is would be unfortunate. I hope it's not. But am I correct in understanding then that the money that would be borrowed here could then be loaned to trucking companies to put different devices on their trucks to make them more fuel efficient, and then their trucks drive all over the countryside? Timely. I guess that is my question. What are we then facilitating the lending? This money we're borrowing here in Oregon, or is being borrowed in Oregon, is then being lent to trucking companies across the United States. Is that what we're really talking about here?
Well, in the case of Cascade Sierra and their programs, are national in scope. They're focused primarily on the West Coast, but they are national in scope. So what this amendment to 289 would do would clarify that In this case, Cascade Sierra, as our example, could borrow a have the state issue a tax-exempt bond through the Treasurer's Office. It would be federally tax-exempt, regardless of where the proceeds are used. It would be Oregon tax-exempt only to the extent those proceeds are used in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Follow-up. Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Please, yes.
So, and this gets us to the one point. The truck is in South Dakota, North Carolina, never comes into Oregon.
Never comes into Oregon. That would be something that you could, under this bill, you could finance that through a conduit bond. You could finance the equipment or the truck through an Oregon bond issuance through the Oregon nonprofit that provided that financing.
Okay, and I guess I
yes.
just, the short answer is yes. In this case, though, the idea is that that bond would, the Oregon portion of it would not be deductible.
That's right. Only to the extent that the bond proceeds are utilized for an Oregon project would they be Oregon tax exempt.
Follow up.
Please, yes.
And is this device, this arrangement, common in other states? Do we see not-for-profits utilizing this technique to make to borrow money on the capital markets at lower rates, and then being able to loan it out to companies that are in the business of trucking at lower rates, and so that what we have is a competitive arrangement, which is supposed to be avoided, as I understand it, not for profits. And I just want I follow through all this because I've represented so many hospitals in similar situations mm-hmm. that tried to get into private business. And I just see some parallels here that are interesting. That's why I'm asking the question.
Okay. Well, in the case of, I don't want to speak too much about Cascades here. I'll let Sharon give you the details on their business. But any nonprofit that borrows through the Facilities Authority can only borrow for qualified projects. Those qualified projects have to be used in a manner that is consistent with their recognized nonprofit purposes. So as part of our due diligence as bond counsel, we scrutinize whether the bond proceeds, what they're being used for, what the building, the program, the equipment is being used for, is to ensure that those are being used in a manner that's consistent with their 501c3 nonprofit purposes. So what we have in the case of Cascade Sierra is a very unique nonprofit, and I think as Sharon has indicated, without any real precedent that we've identified across the country, with a unique mission providing both financial resources to private industry, private small business, but in addition coupling that with an ability to resource grants and other funding sources consistent and driven by a mission of fuel reduction and pollution control.
Thank you.
Can I just say anything? I just wanted to just let you know why we're not competing with the private sector for the business. The majority of the projects that we serve are not being well served by the private sector, and that's why there's such a demand for our loan programs. Even at higher interest rates, there's still a demand, but we would like to have the lower rates to be able to operate the program more efficiently. We make loans to many small businesses, and we also have credit enhancements that we bring in from other states that help support the whole program. And our typical customer is a mom-and-pop trucking company that owns one truck, maybe up to three or four trucks, and they don't have access to capital without our help. They just don't. They can't, even though they can make more money if they put on the equipment. They don't have the initial capital cost to upgrade their trucks to save the money.
Representative Vance, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the small business. I appreciate the jobs. I appreciate the economic opportunity it provides for Oregon. I just want to make sure who's paying for it. And if the state is lending its name and tax advantage to this, then we need to know about it. And whether the focus is supposed to be at the 501c3 level or at the higher level is yet to be determined. But yeah, I find the conversation really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, and then we're going to have to close the hearing because we have one other piece of business before 10 o'clock. It is clear to me that this panel at least thinks this is a great idea. And when we were talking about tax credits, as we were with Representative Bence's comment involved in his question, of course, we're dealing with a very, very limited resource. As I understand it, the federal government authorizes a certain amount of tax-exempt bonds for this purpose on an annual or at least a periodic basis. How much of that do we actually use? Do we use it all? Is it oversubscribed? Is there a lot left on the table? What happens?
I can speak to that, Mr. Chairman. What you're referring to is what's called the private activity bond volume cap, and that's allocated to a variety of projects. It hasn't been fully utilized in Oregon. For the projects that are issued through the Facilities Authority, the private activity volume cap is not applicable. The private activity volume cap does not apply to nonprofit borrowings. So
there's no limit?
So there's no limit in terms of the only limit on the amount that the Facilities Authority can issue is a state statutory limit that we put in the bond bill with each legislative session. And then in addition, I would just note that the private activity volume cap is not implicated by nonprofit borrowings. And in the case of, and we're, again, just to clarify, we're not talking about any Oregon tax credit here or any funding source. We're simply talking about a tax exemption, a state income tax exemption to deduct the interest portion of, again, an Oregon bond.
Right. Well, it's clear to me from the questions that have been asked and the implied attitude, I think, by those questions that this is going to require some additional work if we decide to proceed. You have an amendment that you're working on. Is that right?
That's correct.
When we get that amendment, I think Co-Chair Berger and I will decide whether we want to hold an additional hearing. But my suspicion is if the bill is going to go forward, we're probably going to have to do that. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill, 2205, and open a work session on bill introduction. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that the following LC drafts be submitted, be accepted by the committee as committee bills. Is that the right language?
Yep, go ahead.
LC 1632, dated 12-21-10, LC 2230, dated 11-18-10, LC 2584, dated 12-2-10, LC 2747, dated 12-17-10, LC 3578, dated 2-3-11, LC 3579, dated 2-3-11, LC 3580, dated 2-3-11, LC 3581, dated 2-3-11, LC 3582, dated 2-3-11, LC 3583, dated 2-3-11, LC 3584, dated 2-3-11, LC 3585, dated 2-3-11, and LC 3586, dated 1-24-11. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Berger moves that the following LC drafts be submitted as committee bills, 1632, 2230, 2584, 2747, 3578, 3579, 3580, 3581, 3582, 3583, 3584, 3585, and 3586. Now, before we have discussion, let me note, especially for the new members, that since the time of Chair Lane Shetterly, the committee has considered bill introduction to be a courtesy to get bills into the process. It does not suggest that anyone on the committee is going to support a bill or oppose a bill or take any action on a bill at all. It's simply a way of getting the measures into the process. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection to the motion, the clerk should note that the motion carries unanimously. And the motion passes. We'll introduce these bills. And any other business before the committee?
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
I better close the work session.
Okay. To remind you that on your S drive, the complete text of the introduced bills are out there under House Revenue Committee.
Right. The co-chairs have been flogging the LRO to reduce the amount of paper we get. So that's why you're getting it that way. And we're hoping to do more and more of that. Thank you very much. Anything else? If not, we'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend. Committee is adjourned.